He's supposed to introduce him to read something. I don't know what else.
Good morning. My name is Will Warner. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is the 25th of September, 1985. My home group is the Apopka Big Book in Apopka, Florida. And since we're doing limericks, or whatever the hell you call it,
just read the book.
I'll read the book, sponsor. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order, I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We're not saints. The point is that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if he were sought. And with that, maybe I introduce my sponsor and tonight and the last speaker of the convention, Clancy I from Los Angeles.
My name is Clancy Imislet and I'm an alcoholic. This has been a really touching convention and some great speakers, and especially the last one, my old friend, gave a good talk. And I was taken away by something that was done. And I'm going to ask Sandy, at the end of my talk, would you sing the Marine Corps hymn?
Yeah.
He used to do it and dance, but he can't get around much anymore, so... This really has been an outstanding. I don't know what I've enjoyed a weekend more than this one, because all the speakers have been tremendous and enjoyable, starting with Joe, who stepped in as a substitute and gave as good a talk as I've heard in the last 10 years, I guess. And every participant. Every participant has really been good on top of things, and the singing was fantastic. You know, when you go to a convention, they say, we're going to have somebody sing, you just start to shudder. Oh, Jesus. My wild Irish rose. It was really startling when she sang so beautifully and so lovely, and I noticed she left. I guess she heard what she came to hear. I don't judge. But my topic is the 12th step, which is having had a spiritual awakening is the result of an experience. As a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics, practice these principles in all our affairs. And that is the only step that has been changed since the original Big Book. As you know, the original... If you see this new reproduction, that really is great, of the Big Book, that they issued for the 75th anniversary. They got the same copy, the same covers, the same outside. Jesus, you talked for 3 hours yesterday. Isn't that enough? Anyway, originally the 12th step read, having had a spiritual experience as the result of these steps. And after it came out, the people went up to... Bill said, Bill, you're the only one having spiritual experience. We never had any spiritual. Does that mean we're not going to stay sober? And you didn't have it as a result of these steps. You got it in some magnificent way in the town's hospital. So they brooded about that, what that could mean. Fortunately, the book sold so slowly they had a lot of time to think about it. And finally they came to the conclusion that what Alcoholics Anonymous does in some mysterious way that no one can really define, it brings about an evolutionary spiritual change, not the way Bill Wilson got his, whoom, but the way we get ours. Make amends to that bitch, are you crazy? And wind up with a change in perception. Because it certainly is a correct evaluation. evaluation, I think, to call this a disease of perception. Because what really happens as a result of our stay in AA, life looks different. That's all. This, nothing changes, but our life looks different. And we are, have a better... I think about that sometimes, you know. I've been sober a long time. About 20 years ago, I went through some little fit. And I was thinking, God, I've been going to meetings regularly for 35 years. And there's not, I haven't heard anything new in 20 years. And it's the same old gabble and some newcomer going, oh, I'm sober thing. And I'll stay home and work the program. Well, except I had to go to work. But I'll tell you, I stayed exactly the same. Nothing changed at all in my life. Unfortunately, however, everybody else went to hell. What's wrong with you people, for Christ's sake? Shape up! And I finally came to the reluctant conclusion, I have to go back to meetings to keep you straight. So I'm not here because I want to be here. I'm here because you need it. But you know, the 12th step talks about practice these principles. I remember when I read that the first time, I thought, what practice, what principles? What exactly in the 12th step? Where does it say principle? What's a principle in the 12th step? And it really is a series of changes that take place. I look over my life and I think how fortunate I was, because I went 10 years in and out of AA, in and out of AA, because I could not accept the fact that I was an alcoholic. I did not believe I was an alcoholic. And thank God, this time, I had no desire to stop drinking. I tried again and again to stop drinking, and I knew that it always winds up, one day will come when I'll realize this is just nonsense and I'll go get drunk. So why even try? And I'd lost everything. I'd lost my home and my family. And more importantly, I just had my front teeth kicked out in the Phoenix jail. And I lost my clothes. And I lost my money. I lost my ID. I lost everything. I was just a scattergood on the street. And I, this rainy morning, thrown out of a Skid Row mission and said, don't come back, you phony bastard. And I was right explaining, I'm not a phony bastard. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I wrote, the old L.C. Delmer ads for the Borden Company, were running that very week in Life and Time, New Yorker. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements. But it's hard to explain these things in midair. And I stood outside that mission that morning, cold and rain. I'd learned one thing over the years I'd been slipping, that when you really get down and out and nobody wants anything to do with you, there's one place you're always welcome, an AA club. It's the only place in the world where the worse you look, the better they like it. This one's mine, Fred. So I asked for the... They told me the club was on Wilshire and Fairfax. I didn't know where that was. The guy says, go up this hill to Hill Street, cut over to west to Wilshire and walk west till you come to Fairfax. That doesn't sound bad. Way I went. Turned out to be 7.5 miles in the rain. And then I almost didn't go in. Because I got there and I saw, just sick. There's a guy in the doorway saying, welcome home, son! I thought, oh, shit. But I went in and I had no idea that that would be my sobriety date. That was October 31st, 1958, long time ago. And it's a I look over those years that AA, and I owed so much of it to my first sponsor, a man who, I asked to be my sponsor because he was a movie actor and I thought he had a lot of money. And I turned out he did because he never spent any of it on me. But he was a man of strong ideas. And I was living in the backseat of an abandoned car in the AA Club parking lot, getting whatever spiritual fallout there came through the windows. And he'd come down and get me once in a while, pick me up, take me out to where he's speaking, and buy me something to eat, and then talk to me. And he was really, as I look back, he really wasn't a good sponsor like the other speakers have had, but he was a strong guy. And he got inside my head. And I remember once we went to a meeting, and there was a guy there that got up to say, thank you. I just came here to say thank you. I'm not an alcoholic, I don't believe, but I came here about a month ago. I didn't know why I was having problems, and you said that I was an alcoholic, that I had an alcohol problem drinking. So I stopped drinking, and it's been wonderful. I'm doing fine now, and I came back to say thank you. And old Bob pounced on him after the meeting and said, "We don't want you to come around here again. Thanks for your thanks, but we don't need you." On the way home, I said, "Well, Jesus, Bob, why do you take that attitude? You guys are sober." He said, "He's got an alcohol problem." I said, "Bob, I don't want to get you angry, but AA is designed for people with alcohol problems." He says, "No, it's not. We don't want people with alcohol problems hanging around here. They just take up space and bother us." I said, "What do you think they should do, Bob?" "Well, they should stop drinking, clean up their act, and when they're offered a drink, say no, thank you." I said, "Bob, that doesn't work. I've been trying that for 10 years. I've gone through big success and big failures. It doesn't work." He said, "I guess your problem is an alcohol." "What could it be, Bob?" He said, "You must have what the people in AA have and I have." "What's that, Bob?" He said, "Something called alcoholism, which looks like an alcohol problem, but it isn't, because it's more consistent." I said, "Oh, Jesus, Bob, that's really wonderful to know that. I think I'm cured now." "Shut up," he said. He gave me about a three-hour lecture, most of which I was able to blot out before I went insane. But in that lecture, he changed my life, and I didn't even know it till later. He pointed out the difference. He says, alcoholics are people with alcohol problems are people who drink until they need to stop or cut down, so then they stop or cut down. Alcoholics are people who drink until they need to stop or cut down, so they do, then drink again until they have to stop or cut down, then they drink again until they never end. I said, "Jesus, Bob, well, why do these people drink? It was so terrible for them. I've been going to meetings all over the country." Went to Bob, went to the old mansion down in Pillsbury Mansion there in Minneapolis. I've been to meetings all over the country. Every time the heat was on, I'd go to a meeting for a week till I'd need a drink. You hear these old jokes get up and say, "Well, I just drank and drank and lost my family, lost my home. Just terrible, I continue to drink." I said, "What are these people drinking? What's hurting them so bad?" He said, "They're not drinking because they're hurting so bad." He said, "You don't seem to know much." He said, "The difference is this." He had a cup of coffee. He said, "This were a Johnny Walker, and I took a big drink. The net result would be to almost instantly alter my perception of reality. A little friendlier, a little more colorful." "And I drink some more and I become clever. They don't know it, but I know it. And I drink to sustain a strange feeling, the feeling that I am the way I should be. I am not that frightened, insecure, smart aleck. I am a solid guy with good looks and charm. And it's just a wonderful feeling." You know, you mentioned this morning, Howard, that about the phenomenon of craving. And no one's ever had a definition of that, ever, in AA. There's never been any explanation of it. We all know it's there, but we don't know why. But Bob told me that morning something that made sense to me. He said, the phenomenon of craving, as far as I'm concerned, is that you start to drink and you become something you're not. But you start to sag a little bit and you instinctively drink to hold it. You got to drink to hold it, and drink to hold it, and pretty soon you're drunk, and it doesn't make a difference. But for a while, give me another drink. I'd want to go back to being that craven snot. I want to be me. I said, "Jesus, Bob," after some talk, I said, you make it sound just like my life for the last 15 or 20 years. I've tried so hard." And he said, "There's a name for people like you." And I hate to ask him what it was because he's so profane. Not like me. He said, "I believe you're an alcoholic, kid." I said, "Bob, how can I be an alcoholic? It's true I drink too much, but my problem isn't really alcohol. My problem is all these emotions that eat me up and inadequacies and fears. getting sensual. I have a few drinks. He said, kid, alcoholics aren't people whose problem is alcohol. Alcoholics are people whose answer is alcohol. And if it's your answer, it'll be your problem as long as you live. He told me that, and I thought about that later, and I'll tell you what it did. Everything fell into place. If I'm an alcoholic, it's easy. But I never believed I was an alcoholic because I could always prove my emotions were different. But that was the miracle moment in my life when I think about it. Because if you're an alcoholic, then you got to do this crap. Because if you don't, you feel bad. And I'm a hedonist of the first water. So I was able to do what he said. And he pointed out to me that I had to find a higher power. I said, I can't find God, Bob. I can't return to God. I can't. I didn't tell him why. But because some years before that, I'd been in jail one night when my son died. And that just killed me. It just killed me. And I stopped drinking. And I put my hand in my son's casket. And I said, John, this will never happen again. I could just, oh, I hate this. In fact, I just visited his grave 2 weeks ago up in Wisconsin, where my wife and he are buried together in a little country cemetery. And I stopped drinking. First time in a long time, I came home after work, had dinner with my family, helped them with their schoolwork, went for rides. Great. But then something happened that always happened when I quit drinking. Somebody snuck into my bedroom one night and put an invisible spring in my gut. And the next day they start to tighten it. And it doesn't come out as, I need a drink. It just comes out as a, little restlessness, little irritability. Come on, come on. And it gets worse and worse, and I've tried a lot of things. I spent almost $10,000 in psychoanalysis one time when I was doing well in the Midwest to try to find a break for that, and there's no answer to that. I took your pills, and I read their books, and went to their meetings, and I'll tell you how you break that feeling. Oh, God. But then you say, I'll watch it this time. Never knowing that you can't. And it was such a remarkable thing when I came to understand the nature of my illness. Because I had another puzzle that puzzled me for years. Why is it that jerks who work for me can stop for a couple drinks after work and go home and eat dinner? I have a couple drinks and I'm just ready to go. I didn't mean to. I stopped in for a couple drinks at my home to dinner. And at 1 o'clock, I'm there. Oh, come on. You with anyone, Granny? I should say in passing, I drank a lot in bars, and I have gone, but I've never gone home with an ugly woman. However, I've awakened with a great many of them. Oh, God. Who are you? Where's the girl I brought home? Jesus. But he said, it's quite clear. Don't you understand what I'm telling you? Alcoholics are 1 in 10 of drinkers get an unusual reaction to alcohol. It does something that alters their perception of reality. It changes their life. And the curse of it is all this, is if you don't drink, it becomes intolerable. But you know the answer is always there waiting for you. So it's just a matter of time. And so you stop for 2 drinks after work. Why do you sit there at 1 o'clock? Because after 2 drinks, the guy that stopped for 2 drinks isn't there anymore. The new man is there. Give them all a drink. That's why you can't stop for 2 drinks. I always thought you could. I couldn't imagine why I couldn't. But it gave me a charge that made me a different man entirely. But that was in 1958. And as a result of that, when my son died, one of the things I did, I wrote off God. I believed in God. I was raised in the Norwegian Lutheran Church. I've always believed in God. But I knew God had killed my little son to punish me because I was a sinner. And I shook my fist. Screw you, God! You killed my little boy to get me, or screw you. You can get me in hell, but you won't get me before then, so screw you. I never stuck around anywhere when they talked around God and everyone in your church and everyone in anything. And I told my sponsor, I can't return to God, Bob. He said, fortunately, nothing that I ask you ever return to God. Oh, to a power greater than myself, Bob. Is that supposed to fool me? So it doesn't say that either. Read it. Came to believe. We never ask you to go back to anything. We ask you to start and come to believe in something. Can't you come to believe in a loving God? I said, no. He said, can't you believe in AA? I said, well, I like it better than I used to, but not much. He says, you think I'm doing better than you are? Of course you are, Bob. He said, congratulations. I'm your new higher power. And I could accept that, and that saved my life. That's the best I could have done. And I began doing things he asked me to do. And even though he was outrageous and crazy, I felt sometimes. Because you know, if you're new, you'll discover that your sponsor has very little sense. A lot of wisdom, but no sense. I mean, we were talking about it at breakfast. It's almost as though he's saying, see that wall back there? That's bright green. No, it isn't, Bob. It's kind of a tan, I think. I tell you, it's bright green. It's tan to me, Bob. Well, God damn it, you act like it's green. But he doesn't tell you dumb things like that. He tells you more difficult things. I want you to apologize to that woman. Why should I? Because you called her a bitch. She is a bitch. Why do you think she's a bitch? She told her new girls to stay away from me. But she's right. You go and apologize. And at that moment, your sobriety either goes or stops. Because if you're using your brain, you say, I'm going to apologize to that bitch. However, if you're in the thrall of believing, sorry I called you a bitch. You bitch. No, I want you to go to that meeting. But Bob, they treat me like a piece of crap there. Well, maybe they see you better than you do. So just go there. Don't quit that job. Jesus, Bob, I'm making $1.48 an hour. I used to be a rich man. He said, we ain't now. Go to work. And you do this again and again and again until you're crazy. And one day you look around, the damn wall is green. It's just an odd phenomenon. When I came, I started to do what God, I started to do what he told me. I understood I have to surrender to the fact that there's got to be a power here that's going to restore me to sanity. What's sanity? You can read 10 different medical books and get 10 different definitions. Insanity is easy to define, one form of it. When your brain is under sufficient intense conflict, you can find no answer. It just desperate, it will withdraw to its last gasp effort to maintain its neurotic integrity. It will change its perception of reality. And that is called psychosis. And when you become psychotic, if you're totally psychotic, it's easy to spot and they put you away. But usually it just takes some triggering. You read in the paper, I lived next door to this guy for 10 years, nice man, came home one night for no reason, killed his wife, killed his children, killed himself. Why would he do that? Something triggered his psychosis. But it turns out alcoholics almost never become psychotic. Isn't that wonderful? You'd think we'd be the number one candidates. I asked a guy in Washington once who knew a lot about that. He said, quite easy. He said, alcoholics are people who, if it's bad enough, long enough, will drink alcohol. And they drink alcohol because it alters their perception of reality. You and I have the power to temporarily induce psychosis. Jesus. Happy days. So I come to believe the second step meant what it said. I have to find some way here to believe there's some power here that will make it unnecessary for you to drink alcohol to survive for the rest of my life. Impossible to believe that. And the third step, I can't come to believe in God, but I came to believe in my sponsor. He told me to take an inventory. I'm not going to do that. I have too many secrets. I got a job as a busboy or a dishwasher at the Gaty Delicatessen. I lasted 11 o'clock the first night. And I noticed the busboys were bringing in more dishes than the waitresses were taking out. And I could see they were bringing dishes in from other restaurants to humiliate me because I was an Anglo. So I just piled up their damn dishes and I got fired. I went back to the club, meeting had gone home, everybody had gone home, just the manager sitting there until 12, John Sullivan. I said, Sully, I got fired at my job. Christ, as a dishwasher. I've been sober 6 months and I can't hold a job. And people I got sober with got cars and girlfriends and everything. I can't even hold a job as a dishwasher. I'll be back living in that damn abandoned car again because I can't pay my rent. And I was waiting for him to see how he talked me out of it. He said, good idea, Clancy. You think you want to get drunk? Go ahead. What? He said, there's about 180 people in this club who think you're a real asshole. There are 6 people who like you. They have to defend you incessantly. If you get drunk, you may make those 6 people feel bad, but 180 people will feel happy. Just think of that. Not me. I won't do it. Give me some paper. I'm going to write my inventory. I went in the back room and I didn't write it by the book. I wrote it. This is almost though I vomited on the paper. Just everything I could dredge up. Just, I did this, did that, failed to do it. And I got done. Oh, God, that was a terrible experience. But I felt cleansed a little bit. And I stuck it under the back seat of my car, or that old car. I wasn't sleeping there at the moment. And I think that old snitch John Sullivan called my sponsor because he called me in the morning at the club and said, I understand now you took your inventory. I didn't know that. Never mind how I know that. Sponsors know these things. He said, we're going to take your fifth step tonight. I said, Jesus, Bob, I can't. It's so much on that paper, several sheets, I can't assimilate it. I mean, I have to. There's stuff in there I never even thought about for 10 years, 20 years. It's just guilt and fear and despair. Shut up, he said. I'll pick you up at 6 o'clock. Picked me up at 6 o'clock. We rode along the ocean to Oxnard, 40 miles. He gave me a flashlight, and I read this. And God, it sounded even worse than I remembered. And I knew he was going to make me get out of the car and walk back to Los Angeles. I'm all done, Bob. He said, you're done now? Yeah. He leaned over and said, that's the best thing you've done since you got sober, kid. And I said, thought it was. I took an inventory. I have taken that trip up along the ocean there over 100 times since then. I'm on the driver's side. The other puke is over there reading. And I'll tell you something. You never hear anything new. They're always the same. Different specifics, but always the same emotions. Fear, guilt, anger, resentment. Always the same. And 1 week I listened to a guy who was born underneath the Juarez Bridge, never knew who his father was. And 4 days later I listened to Jack Dempsey's daughter, who says dead, so I could talk about it. And emotions exactly the same, resentment, hatred, but different specifics. And it's an amazing thing how similar alcoholics are when you get to that level. I travel around a lot, and I've heard a lot of alcoholic talks all over the world. I mean, weren't formal talks, but sitting in meetings. And God, they talk about the same things. Go to Singapore, and except for the accidents, you hear the same whining you hear in your home group, you know. I don't think they're treating me right. Oh, really? Oh, shit. And my friend Sandy gave a great talk on the sixth and seventh step, but he's in an advanced spiritual state that I'm not in yet, so I take a simpler version of it. Shape up. And I'll tell you, there's really a couple of approaches to the steps. Bill Wilson's approach, which then he went on to read the 12 and 12, right through 12 and 12, and Dr. Bob's, which was always quite simple. Let me read you what Dr. Bob said about the steps. In 1947, as finally expressed and offered, they, the 12 steps, are simple in language, plain in meaning. They are workable by any person having a sincere desire to obtain and keep sobriety. The results are the proof. Their simplicity and workability are such that no special interpretations and certainly no reservations have ever been necessary. And it becomes increasingly clear that the degree of harmonious living which we achieve is in direct ratio to our earnest attempt to follow them literally under divine guidance to the best of our ability. And boy, that's just, to me, that's what the steps are. They're simple, designed for complex people that take a long time to get simple enough to work them. And that's a very hard project. I did the best I could. I tried to improve myself. And then my sponsor got me through the amends steps. And he made me make amends to people I didn't like, which hurts. But I was feeling pretty good by this time. And one time I spent $500, $485, to fly to Dallas to make amends to a guy down there. And I just came in and I said, Norm, I'm here to make amends. He said, what's that about? I said, I'm an A now and I want to make amends for hurting you and stealing your truck. And he said, what are you an A for? I said, I'm an alcoholic, Norm. He said, I never knew that. I never thought you were an alcoholic. Well, what did you think I was, Bob? I thought you were an asshole. Now, I think so now. Get out of my office. I was certainly glad to have spent that $485. But on the other hand, I had to go back to the University of Wisconsin that I'd been expelled from. Now, you were expelled halfway through your senior... Well, you happened to... I was expelled 1 week before graduation. Wasn't my fault. But I had to go back there and make amends to the chair. The guy who was now chancellor had been the dean who wrote a note, I've covered for you as long as I can, but I can't cover this one. I can't cover you breaking into the university and having sex with a girl in the faculty lounge. She wasn't that good, really, actually. But anyway. I went back to see him, and he refused to see me. But I went back to see my folks the next year, and he refused to see me. I said, my sponsor said, go back and see him till he sees you. And I said, the next time I was there, I heard him say, all right, send him in, I'll get rid of him. And he said, what are you doing here, Clancy? I said, I just wanted to know that I felt so bad about what I'd done, and I'm sorry you found it necessary to expel me, but I think you were right, and I want to make amends to it, if I can do the main thing to make as we do. He said, well, you should be sorry. You hung me out to dry. I covered for you and covered for you, and you left me looking like a fool. He said, I wish you well. Now, move along. That's the end of that. Amend. The next year, in the autumn, I got a call from a woman, said, this is the chancellor's secretary. He says that he knows you two don't get along real well, but we are supposed to have an alumni luncheon in Los Angeles next week, and we just found out the man in charge of it died some time ago. Nobody knows anything about anything. He wants to know if you could possibly help us find a place. I said, I'll call you back. I called her back, and couple hours, I said, how about the Coconut Grove where the stars go every night? You can have lunch there on Sunday. Is that nice? She said, oh. I didn't tell her I sponsored the manager. It wasn't that hard a thing to do. And I said, but on one, look at that poor hunchback girl. I told you to ring those bells. Don't get out there. I said, I want to be invited to that luncheon. And she said, well, I'll call you back. She called back and said, okay, you can come. But I had him come. At that time, I had just, about 2 or 3 years before that, left advertising, which was my want, in a fit of hideous feeling good, and started my 40-year stint as running the mission on Skid Row that threw me out in 1958. That's what I still do for a living. And he says, what's this I hear about you trying to help people? I run a mission down Skid Row. He said, that's not like you. You're the most selfish, self-contained person I ever met. I just can't see you trying to help anyone. Well, true. He said, I like to see this place in all its pristine purity. Let's go over there. Don't call them and tell them we're coming. Let's just go. So we went over there. It was Sunday afternoon, sparkling clean. Guys down the street, Hi, Mr. Clancy. Went in my office, sparkling clean, some awards on the wall and stuff. He said, I can't believe this. This is a modern-day miracle. I hope you do all right. That was the end of that. Well, felt better. But the following February, I got a call from his secretary again saying, did you know the chancellor is retiring this June, 1980? I said, no, give him my best wishes. I'll send him a card. She said, that's not the interesting part. The interesting part is he's named you Distinguished Alumnus of the Year and would like to have you speak at commencement. Will you do that? And I said, you bet. And I took all my kids and we went back there. All my kids would see there where they came from. I got a whole bunch of kids. And I got up and spoke at commencement. My mother was sitting there and my father there. They'd been divorced for many years, but they both cried that I was because I was their only child and I'd been a terrible mess. And got all done. Wonderful, wonderful weekend. That was the end of that. And I thought, now there's the men worth making. But most events aren't that dramatic. They're just kind of cruddy. But I'll tell you one thing. I discovered this in Texas, and I discovered it in many other places. Once you make an amend to a person, you never hate him again. You may not like him, but you don't have to lie awake thinking about him anymore. It's just a good thing. And I think the amend step... It's not surprising at all that I think there are 3 or 4 major turning spots. One is the first step, and one is the fourth step, and one is the eighth and ninth step, and one is the 12th step, I suppose. But I try to live a little bit better, and I was working and doing well. Last year, Bob Darrell and I were speaking in Springfield, Illinois, or Massachusetts, and his topic was the 10th step. And he gave an unusual discussion on it. He said, you know, we're all supposed to say we're sorry when we're wrong. But stop and think about it. There are some people we've been wrong to for years and years and years. And we just take it for granted. We say, I'm sorry, but that doesn't do it. These people deserve better. And I got on the plane home, I got thinking about that. I have given my wife a terrible life intermittently. Just terrible. And I've not been a good husband. I haven't been a understanding. I've tried some. Sometimes I do quite well. Sometimes I don't. But I really am grateful for it. Because we've been married 64 years, and I got a lot to be sorry about. I got home, and she was in bed sleeping. So I wrote a little funny note explaining all this, that I really am sorry. She was a darling woman, and I'm very happy that she was my wife and so on. Then I went to bed and figured maybe she'd get it when she got up and get me some coffee. But she was still sleeping when I got up, so I left it on the kitchen table and went to work. I just got to work and my daughter called me. She said, hurry home, mother just died. And I rushed. daughter's home, and she said, we were sitting at the table, mother and I, having coffee. And she was showing this card to all of us, and she said, laughing and having a good time. She just took a sip of coffee, and her eyes closed, and she never opened them again. I thought, oh my God, I'm so glad I wrote that note. Oh God, I'm glad I wrote that note. That took about 9/10 of the horror of her death away from me. Because he'd been kind of sick. And I don't feel bad when somebody sick passes away, really, because they got out of their pain. But we buried her up in northern Wisconsin, a little country graveyard, between her mother and her son. And I know she's sleeping well. But I ask to God, of all the amends I've ever made, nothing has ever pleased me as much as that little note I wrote to my wife the other day she died. Who would guess such a thing would happen? But you don't know what's going to be, so you might as well keep doing it. The 11th step, I'm sorry to say, I look back, I am not a meditator. I'm a promotion guy. Engineers are meditators. Find X in this equation. It's right there. But I know I should meditate. What I've tried to do from time to time, sometimes I get jammed on the freeway, easy to do in Los Angeles, but on the freeway, I'll stop and say a little gratitude prayer, meditation to God. And sometimes I'm waiting somewhere, waiting in a doctor's office, doing something where I am confined to stop, and then I can meditate a little bit. And I think the important thing about the 11th step to me is the second half. We don't talk about it much. Praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Because all my life, and all of us have been dickering, you know, you do this and I'll do this, and if you get me out of this jam, I'll do this, and on and on. Asking for nothing, praying only for knowledge. And for the last, well, first I couldn't do much about it because I didn't have much of a belief in God, but He died. I got a guy named Chuck Chamberlain to be my sponsor, who incidentally, in that book you got of his, where he attacks me, I don't care. I wrote the introduction. It's better than anything he ever wrote. But he says to his book, I have this guy up in Santa Monica who claims I'm his sponsor, but he's not an AA member. AA members share. He tells these newcomers what to do. Bum, 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 bum. I thought about that later. Why do I do that? Because that's my sponsor saved my life by doing that. And that's why I do it, I guess. But I got him to be my sponsor. I said, you know, came up to conversation. I said, God hates me. I don't want to monkey with God. God hates me. He said, son, you're not important enough for God to hate. Yes, I am. But that night I said the first prayer I'd said in many, many years. And I said, thanks for keeping me sober. And I've been praying earnestly then, ever since, all these years. Prayed last night is the prayer I always say. Dear God, among other things I say, help me to know thy will for me and the power to carry it out. Because after all these years, I can't seem to find God's will for me. I mean, I find it occasionally, things go well, but then I get out of whack. So I've prayed earnestly every night for 45 years for God's will for me. And I guess maybe someday I'll get some of it. But it's such a great feeling to go to sleep at night and pray and thank God for my sobriety and ask Him to help me stay sober and ask Him to find His will for me. And I feel more complete. I could have almost missed it if I hadn't tried that one little prayer. But I look over the 12 steps and what the 12 steps have done for me. You wouldn't think as much by looking at me because I talk bad and I'm mean to people. But it has changed my perception of reality. Now, about a month ago, I finished 40 years of running this mission on Skid Row. That's a tough job, you know. And tomorrow morning, well, most of you are getting up. I'll get up early and I'll go down through Beverly Hills to Skid Row and park my car under the building and take my walk around the building, and I'll see who died this weekend, who smashed their head to the sidewalk in convulsions, who overdosed on that damn crack, who just did terrible things, who stabbed somebody in the fit of crazy rage. Then I'll go into my office and my staff and I will try to find ways to get these poor bastards off the street, because it's almost impossible on Skid Row. Not because it's the economy of it all, it's because they have a mindset. They're driven to a mindset where they can't stand conflict, and conflict makes them run to their drugs or alcohol or whatever way away. But we get quite a few. My meeting, my home group, the Pacific group, there's hardly a meeting that there isn't one birthday from somebody who thanks the Midnight Mission for their start. And they got going to AA. And then I'll go home and have dinner with my grandson, who's now my surrogate housekeeper. And he's a nice kid. He doesn't drink. He doesn't smoke. He's a nice kid. But God, he's a pain in the ass. He leaves all the tubes open with the top off and hides my razor and just... He's a good kid. And I'll have dinner with him. Then I'll go to a meeting tomorrow night. And I'll sit in the back row of Ohio Street and I'll judge the speaker. And then I'll go home and I'll go to sleep. Now, if you're new, that may mean something to you. So these old timers, they don't understand that. But just think, go to bed and go to sleep. What a blessing that is. What a blessing that is. I spent my life pitching and tossing. And I can thank God for the 12 steps of AA. And I think of the thing when Dr. Bob was dying, and they had this convention in Cleveland to try to sell the concept of the 12 traditions. That was 1950, long after the book was written. But AA was coming apart, and Bill Wilson, the last gasp effort to save AA, wrote the traditions and saved us. But they had a little convention up there, the first large group of sober alcoholics in the history of America, probably. And they called on Dr. Bob to speak, and they didn't think he should be able to speak because he had cancer, dying of cancer. And they said, "You probably don't want to speak, Bob." He said, "Well, I got to speak. I've got 15 years sober. I've got the second longest sobriety in the world." So he got up, and he just gave a so-so talk, his usual boilerplate. I want to welcome you all to Cleveland. Glad to see all of you here. I'm so glad that some small thing I did 15 years ago helped bring this about. He said, I hope all of you boys and girls go back to your groups and tell them we all get out of AA what we put into it. It's pretty much of a deal. And so I want to apologize for I'm not very well. I've been in bed most of the past few months. My health hasn't come back the way I thought it was. But I'm glad to be here. But then he stopped and said, "But I do want to call your attention to one or two things, two or three things maybe, that are of interest to me." And he was always a better 12-stepper than Bill was. And he knew he was dying, and he had to convey what he knew then, because he wouldn't be alive much longer. So he tried to synthesize the primary things he believed in. He said, "Let me call your attention to two or three things that may be of interest. First of all, let us remember to keep our program simple. Let's not loss it all up with Freudian complexes, which may be of interest to the scientific mind, but has nothing to do with our work here. Our work here, when reduced to the last, consists of love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. And secondly," he said, "let us guard that erring member, the tongue, and try to use it with kindness and understanding. And there isn't a person in this room or any room like it who doesn't know exactly what he means. We're all wonderful when things are going our way. Love is the answer, baby." But if that's somebody toward us, we put the terrible curse of all time on him. I don't even believe that son of a bitch is alcoholic. And finally he said, "None of us would be here today if someone hadn't taken the time to explain things to us. Maybe take us to a few meetings, give us a pat on the back when we need it. Let us never reach that stage of smug complacency We are too busy to help our brother who still suffers in the blackness of alcoholic despair. And he sat down and died shortly thereafter. But that those words have echoed down. That they're as true tonight in Orlando or this morning as they were when he said them or any time after that. They're always true. They're the truths of AA, really. When you get off the elevator in the World Service Office, I'm sure if you've ever been there, you know, on the wall they have that whole talk. It's written down on the wall. Because Alcoholics Anonymous has this magic. Two great magics. One magic, it can get through the wall, but my case is different. Identification, absolutely imperative. And secondly, maybe if I can gain trust in who's got through that wall, I will do what they say even though I disagree with it. And that's the biggest curse, the hardest thing in AA, when your mind says, that can't help me. Yes, it can. No, it can't. But you do it anyway. As they always say, you know, my mind is not a very good friend of mine. Thankfully, my feet go where it's supposed to go. And I wind up where I'm supposed to be, but I didn't want to be there. Because the Alcoholics Anonymous works. And this weekend, I think, we have heard great testimonials to the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, presented well, intelligently, with a degree of skill and ability that should cherish us. I hate to put money in his pocket, but you should get a copy of the tapes and play them once in a while. Or if you can't afford it, oh, I don't have my wallet, well. But the great gift, of course, is the 12th step, is after having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we take some minutes to try to help others who many times don't deserve it. Have you ever noticed that? You don't deserve help. You don't actually say it, but you think it. But you do it anyway. And you never who's going to... It's the oddest thing in AA. The people who come here full of zeal and enthusiasm, next year they're gone. Some dull, laggard, slug.
I'm going to get my year. What do you think of that, you some bitch?
Who knows who's going to stay? So you got to give them all the same shot. And you listen to their inventories. Yeah. And A's are also, I don't think you want to give people who are struggling sobriety much intense, intricate material. Teach them what you were taught. What made you stay here? Because Alcoholics Anonymous is the greatest gift people like us will ever have. I said this three times last night. I'll say it one more time. Just think, you and I, through no merit of our own, or any choice even, have been born into the only window where there's been people like us allowed to live in the world with dignity. And it's worth everything it takes to stay here and help our brother man. Thank you.